I like that, actually. I like that in a lot of ways, the work that I do day to day is also my identity in the community. And it's nice that that work is appreciated. So in that regard, it's very rewarding.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. What's the common thread between wildlife conservation, performing arts, and independent cinema? That would be Mike Steinberg, a leader in community nonprofit entrepreneurship in Montana. Mike is executive director of both the International Wildlife Film Festival and Missoula's Roxy Theater. The Roxy Movie House operated from 1937 till a fire destroyed the building in 1994. That disaster became an opening for the International Wildlife Film Festival, a juried Missoula film festival founded in 1977. The IWFF purchased the Roxy in 2002, shaping the space into a combination of festival headquarters, kids' film academy, and wildlife film incubator. In 2013, Mike took over as IWFF festival director. He launched year-round movie programming, which transformed the Roxy into today's double-headed incarnation. It's simultaneously a community art house movie theater and home base for the world's longest-running wildlife film festival, not to mention a hub for live comedy, music, and theater. What's Mike's vision for the two prospering organizations? What have Vinyl Records got to do with it? And is it true that he got fired from Hollywood not once, but three times? Today on Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, we uncover the secrets behind Mike Steinberg's dual roles. Production support for Can Do comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Mike, glad you could join me today.
Thanks, Arnie.
As many of you know, Mike is a DJ on Montana Public Radio's Freeforms. But today he's joining me not in that capacity, but to talk about his dual roles as executive director of the International Wildlife Film Festival and the Roxy Theater in Missoula, Montana. So how did you make it to Missoula, Montana from St. Louis, Missouri?
I visited a friend who was attending the University of Montana in the late 80s. He was studying ceramics, my best friend from high school. And he's like, you got to check it out. This town's great. And so I just came out to visit and I liked it so much that I kind of put it in the back of my head, like, okay, after I do film school, because at the time there actually wasn't a film school option, I did sort of toy with coming to the creative writing program here, but I really wanted to pursue film school. So I was like, okay, after I finish film school, maybe I will. And in fact, I did. I moved out in 98 after I finished my master's degree and just thought I was really disenchanted with Hollywood and, movie making, and thought, okay, if I live in Missoula, Montana, I can, maybe I'll find some ways to make independent films or do, documentaries or something. And sure enough, that's kind of the path that I took. And then it bounced me back and forth, lived in Europe for a while, lived back in St. Louis and taught at my alma mater, Webster University. And at some point in, when would it have been? 2008. Oh yeah. I moved back out here to run the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival, had a job offer for that. And that's kind of what landed me back here on both feet. I mean, in that interim from 1989 to 2008, there was at least five times I was trying to make it happen in Missoula. And then that really was what kind of got me back here. And I did that for about 5 years and then moved over to the Roxy in 2013.
Where did your love for films come from?
Well, it actually came from my dad. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. My dad had a movie theater in the basement. It was a 16-millimeter projection with initially a bed sheet hanging in the basement and folding chairs. Eventually was able to kind of build it out into a cute little theater with, actual movie theater seats and sconce lighting. It remained 16 millimeter. He never moved over to video projection or anything like that. So we grew up watching movies, and it was kind of the go-to spot in the neighborhood where kids would come and Halloween movies and birthday party movies, that sort of thing. And it was kind of a novelty because, cable TV and home video VHS was catching on, and all these kids had cable and and VCRs, but we just had these 16-millimeter film prints.
And you never wanted to be in front of the camera? You really felt that behind the camera was the right place for you?
Oh, I don't know. I was kind of I was a child actor. I did a lot of, you know, theater and, in fact, had an agent when I was about 11, 12 years old and did some commercial work. Ralston Purina and Budweiser, and there was, you know, a number of big corporations and big kind of advertising agencies in St. Louis. So found some work. But yeah, I mean, I don't I met someone and she was going to film school and I thought, this was like 1989, maybe 90. It's like, oh, you can do that? That's, you know, I don't know why. It just wasn't even, I mean, today, of course, it's sure. What do you want to do? You want to be a lawyer or a filmmaker?
Right.
Your mom wants you to be a lawyer.
Well, you can do both at the same time.
You're better off doing both, as it turns out. No, I pursued film in that regard. And it seemed like that's, you know, that was always interesting to me. And it wasn't in that kind of dreadful middle school, high school period where you couldn't even decide that you were interested in something like that. At least in the 90s, that's the way it felt. Or the 80s, I guess.
And you bounced around from the 90s to you came here. And I understand during that period, you were fired from Hollywood 3 times.
I was indeed. Yeah. It's a, you know, not to be judgy, but they certainly were these kind of moments of entitlement from the people who were my boss and different people in each case. But one of them was getting fired from an art department for just making a comment that I didn't think the antique bed that we had just set up looked right. And they took it the whole wrong way, as if I was saying their art direction didn't look right. I just literally mean, we just built this bed, you know, this silly little bed, and it didn't, to me, it didn't look right. Literally, I think we screwed it up. I was the driver working for a production office on a Bill Murray movie that came to St. Louis, and I couldn't find the hotel. I'm supposed to be the local guy, you know, which I was, but I didn't know where this hotel was, and all the streets are one way downtown. Anyway, I couldn't get to the guy to his hotel, and so he had me fired. He was the production manager, big guy named Wolfgang. And then I got fired by the Muppets for not answering the phone. So I think that 1-2-3 lesson was like, I don't want anything to do with that world. Still love movies. I mean, a couple of them are that I like come from Hollywood, but most of them come from the outskirts or from different countries.
So you're still a filmmaker, but you run two organizations. You run the International Wildlife Film Festival. You run the Roxy Theater. How do you combine that together?
Technically speaking, it's all one organization. I mean, the Roxy, we've just officially changed our name to the Roxy Theater because over the last 7 years, we've been able to establish that identity in the community. And the Wildlife Film Fest goes all the way back to 77, so 44 years, 43 years now. It kind of has its own identity, but for the sake of organizational structure, it's under the umbrella of the festival, of the theater, sorry, which includes our educational programming and two other film festivals that we've since started in the last 7 years, one for kids and one that's sort of devoted to independent film. So managing all of that, I have a tremendous staff. There's about 18 people year-round at the theater, including administrative staff, festival staff, front of the house to run the theater itself, technical staff to run the booth. Because the strength of that team and the talent of that team, I do have greater flexibility than I think someone who might be, you know, an independent theater owner who has to do everything from sell the tickets to, you know, sweep the theater to run the film.
The Roxy is known as a community theater. So what does that really mean?
Well, that means that we have strong relationships with individuals in our community and organizations, and we do a tremendous amount of partnership where we co-present films or we host special screenings. And we run a theater in a way that is geared towards the community. So we have a strong membership program. We're very responsive to that member base and the audience base in general. So if someone sends me an email that says, hey, Mike, did you know about this? Or, you know, through our programming, et cetera, how about this film? Don't you think this would be great for Missoula? Then we definitely give it consideration. And sometimes we just respond on the spot, like, yep, we just booked it. Sounds great. Thanks. It'll start, you know, in 2 weeks. So there's a relationship to our community that I think is a lot different from the traditional model of a movie theater. And I don't mean this in any offensive way, but it's a for-profit operation and it's designed just to maximize how much money can be made. And they bank on the marketing budgets of big studios and big pictures. They bank on the desire for salty treats at a theater and gouge the prices. I mean, there's a lot of sort of operations that are typical movie theater stuff that's not really our style. I mean, you know, no doubt if a film like, for example, Parasite, which picked up a tremendous amount of attention after its through the award season and all the marketing behind that. I mean, of course, that was a windfall for us because people started hearing about a movie in December and January that we had had since November. You know, it was doing pretty well and we just held on to it and then it just picked up again. So sure, I mean, the mechanisms of how people find out about movies are similar in our model, as is the kind of mainstream model, but it takes a lot more effort to connect to community, connect to audience, build the habit of movie going. That's how we talk about it, is we're mm-hmm. we're not only promoting these films, we're promoting the habit of going to the movies.
Theaters have a tough time in general. Why did you decide in 2002 to acquire the Roxy and renovate it and, you know, expand it? You're even putting in another theater in the near future. Why did you want to decide to undertake that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it could have been maybe the worst time to buy a movie theater. You know, I wasn't on board then. I don't know if I would have disagreed with the idea because it's so romantic in some ways. But in 2002, the International Wildlife Film Fest was led by a different director and had an almost completely different board. And it was the Roxy was purchased as a home for the festival because up until that point, they had kept offices around town. They had a place downtown by the Children's Theater. And once upon a time, they were out at Fort Missoula. But the idea of having a central location where they could run the festival and be there year round is what motivated them to buy it in 2002. As far as my involvement in it beginning in 2013, you know, at that point, it was also a seemingly really bad idea to run a movie theater. You know, shifts in interest at that, you know, to streaming video, for example. I mean, in 2002, when there was initially bought, you know, cable and home video was just booming, and the idea of a brick and mortar space, they didn't call it that then, but what were you going to do with that? You know, how are you going to make money with that? And of course, they had a completely different model in mind, which was that people would come see environmental films and wildlife films year round. But when I took over in 2013, the proposal to the board was to utilize what had become kind of an unutilized space. At that point, the festival was there in April, and that was just about it. A few rentals throughout the year. The opera, the Met Opera, had been presented there year round. But other than that, there really wasn't much of a presence in the sense that we think of as a public space or a cinema. So my proposal was, hey, look, we've got three screens here. We're basically treating this historic building as an overpriced office space, you know, because we're not really using it for public good. I had experience, as I said, with Big Sky Documentary Film Festival. I'd also been the director of the Webster University Film Series for 5 years, and we had presented a lot of alternative cinema. And just looking around, art house, this notion of what art house cinema was for mm-hmm. Missoula was kind of arbitrary at best. The Wilma Theater was presenting films then, but, you know, it was kind of not really engaged with the community. I mean, also available for rental, so people would come and show films there occasionally. And, of course, the Big Sky Film Fest was there, and even the Wildlife Film Fest used it. But the Roxy was so underutilized and kind of perfectly designed for the sort of thing that we wanted to do, which is present art house. So films that don't otherwise bring in audiences, don't have the big budgets, but deserve to be seen, and program it specifically for our audience, our community, and kind of grow that and find out what does Missoula want out of an art house. So we have an idea, because we're Missoulians, and we have an idea what Missoula wants, but we're going to be completely open to the possibilities of what's going to do well here. So classic films, there was a voracious appetite for seeing classics on the big screen once again. Documentaries that otherwise wouldn't play in town, foreign films, art house films, independent films, all of that began to kind of flourish, as well as, even from the very beginning, alternative events in the theater. So, for example, stand-up comedy, music, live accompaniment to a silent film, all of that. We just threw everything against the wall to see what stuck, I think, is kind of our approach.
Mike, every time I go to the Roxy, it's pretty busy. You're adding another theater.
Yeah.
How have you been so successful?
Well, it's almost entirely through community support. I mean, it's literally what you're saying is it's busy at the theater. We recently reduced the number of seats that we have in the theater by putting in bigger seats, and it impacted us in a couple of ways. One, we had fewer tickets to sell, and two, we suddenly had more people. in part because the new seats are so much more comfortable. The sound is so much better. The improvements we've made just made the movie going experience that much better. But our membership base kind of blew up. We did a sale, which we had done 3 years in a row, but we did a sale in November on memberships and ended up with something like 300 new memberships over a period of about 5 days.
How many members do you have in total now?
We have about 1,700. Yeah, I think that was
That's phenomenal, really.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's great. And so that to me is just the evidence there that people like what we're doing and they want it. They want it as part of the community. You know, a few years ago, and even nowadays with streaming services, as you know, it's kind of taking a lot of attention, there's a lot of talk about the demise of the, you know, movie theater. When we got things going 7 years ago, it really wasn't a great time. I mean, people were talking about movie theaters closing all over the country, and the switch to digital really closed thousands of theaters because they couldn't afford to shift from their 35 millimeter projection to digital. So it was a big problem. So again, I think the idea that movie theaters are under duress because of streaming services or because of other outside influences, in reality, that's something you've heard since talkies, you know, the threat.
Well, it's gone through a lot of periods. In the 50s, when color television came into vogue, the movie theaters were all going to be gone, right?
Yeah. And then they responded with kind of ridiculous things like, you know, CinemaScope and expanding the idea of the drive-in and all these, giving people a reason to go. And it's true that that's still what we do, give people a reason to go. In some sense, there's films that you can only still see in movie theaters. But then there's films that are available on other platforms that people want to go to see in a movie theater because that experience of being in a public space and the sort of joint communal experience of watching a movie together, that's something that people desire. More people in the U.S. Haven't seen a movie in a movie theater than those who have in the last year, right? I would say that number is higher. But there's still that core of people who want that experience. And not just new films. They want to see classic films, or they want to see, you know, have special experiences like, you know, live accompaniment to silent films. The sort of thing, again, that you can't really get at home.
We're speaking with Mike Steinberg, executive director of Missoula's Roxy Theater and the International Wildlife Film Festival. Production support for Can Do comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. How did you learn the skills to manage an organization? You're an artist. You're a filmmaker. Running an organization is a whole different set of skills. Where did those come from?
It is different. And yet, filmmaking, producing in particular, is not dissimilar. And my greatest skill is to recognize talent. I see talented people, I bring them on board, I put them in charge, and they flourish, the organization flourishes. And I get a lot of credit. I just hired the right people, you know? It's that adage in filmmaking where they say casting is 90% of the job. And, you know, I've made a few mistakes over the past 7 years with people, but not as many as you'd think. I mean, I think it's occasionally been a circumstance where somebody thinks they're right for the job. I think they might be right for the job, and they're not so much, so we kind of find something else for them to do. That's really what that skill is for this organization. And it's an odd place. I mean, we're most of us are artists. There's filmmakers, there's musicians, there's writers. It's a bunch of oddballs, a bunch of weirdos, bunch of the lunatics running the asylum, which was a adage from United Artists, right? That's what they said about Chaplin and Fairbanks and Mary Pickford, which in fact, that's where I was fired. The Muppets were housed out of Raleigh Studios, which was Mary Pickford's office. In fact, it said on the door, the Mary Pickford studio or whatever.
And there was the actual movie where the inmates were running the asylum in Queen of Hearts with Alan Bates.
Oh, yeah. Oh, right.
So do you have a mentor?
You know, my mentor just passed away last week. An incredible man, David Kluhl. He's a poet. And it hit me so hard. I didn't see it coming. I've been in contact with Dave since college. And God, it hit so hard. I was like, this is a guy, he's a tremendous writer, taught me almost everything I know about writing and about poetry. And he's the voice that I've been carrying around in my head for 30 years. You know, how would David, what would David think about this thing? Or what, you know, sort of writing for not so much his approval, but yeah, for his approval. I was actually lucky enough to have two great teachers at Webster, David, who taught the creative writing and poetry, and another man named Joe Schuster, who is very much alive and is also a writer and was kind of in the media school. So he was basically my anchor in film school, because the gentleman who headed up the actual production program for film, I never connected to, had lots of, you know, crummy things to say about him, which I won't air now. God bless him. But no, Joe Schuster is a novelist and taught media writing. So he was, sort of this 1-2 punch between Dave Kluhl and Joe Schuster.
I want to go back to you as a filmmaker. How do you get your inspiration for your projects?
You know, I was making documentary for a number of years. You know, I was just being open-minded to character. Like, is this person interesting enough to be in a film? Is this story interesting enough? And then at some point, after making documentary for about 15 years, I thought, why don't I make fiction films anymore? Why don't I do little short films or anything? And then I realized I had these ideas that I had kind of just left behind that became uninteresting to me. So I went and looked at them again. And strangely, from this novel that I had started to write at that point, probably 20 years before, I found three different strands that ended up becoming short films that I've made in the last couple of years. The first one was called Lester Leaps In, and it's about a guy who runs a lumber he's sort of the HR department of a lumber mill in the 70s, and he's tasked with making a safety film. The other film that we made in about a year and a half ago, Kelly Boma, who's a local filmmaker and my partner, we made this film together. It's called The Foghorn Trilogy, and part of it was based on a strand from this original kind of manuscript for a novel that I'll never finish. She acted in it and co-directed with me and co-wrote the script. She just recently won a big grant from the Tribeca Film Institute and is making a documentary this summer, which I'm shooting and co-producing with her. So I don't know. I mean, I think that the long way around the barn to answer the question is the inspiration comes from what's right there in front of you. And I'm not beholden to studios or funders or, you know, in the way that a lot of filmmakers are. And so just kind of do what interests me.
Can you walk us through the process of making a film from conception, funding, to when it's actually aired or shown?
Yeah. I mean, I can walk you a little through the process for Foghorn Trilogy, which is the last film we completed. And, you know, that started, as I said, a long time ago with this idea about a DJ who wakes up and he's lost his voice. So the idea started quite a long time ago with this thread in the novel that didn't get finished. I was in a bar in Chicago with Kelly, and we had decided that we were going to make a film together. And so I threw this idea out. I was like, well, what if there's this DJ and he can't talk? You know, how's he going to deal with that? And then we just started riffing on the idea, literally writing on a napkin in this Chicago bar. And that became eventually, I mean, we got a pretty good bit of framework out of that. So then we came back home to Missoula and wrote the script. We hoped to do it that year. And then we put it on hold for another creative project that was a dance piece that she was working on, and then came back around the following year. You know, in that case, we didn't have any funding at all. And it was a small enough project, and it was, you know, it was a 13-minute short film. A lot of it was shot in our home. Kelly was in it. Our friends were, you know, the crew and the other cast. So we were able to kind of cobble it together for about $20,000 between us, just because we believed in the project and wanted to do it. Paid people nominally, like, this is a week of your time. I mean, even though it's only a 13-minute film, it's going to take us a week to do it. But we all had fun. And we actually, the film happened literally in our house. It was really kind of a wonderful thing. My daughter was the slate, you know, walked in and slated it. Then we worked kind of with an editor over about a period of about 6 months, and we began submitting it to film festivals. We were lucky enough to get into the St. Louis International Film Festival, where we won best narrative short film. From there, weirdly, it was kind of scattergun approach to festival entry, you know, because we don't have a publicist or, you know, anyone doing that for us. or even a producer's agent. I mean, it's us. We ended up in a film fest in Malta, and not Malta, Montana, Malta, the island. And there's a handful of other festivals that are sort of down the road. And, you know, at some point in there, we did a special screening locally so we could share it with the people who were involved and with our community. But, you know, it's really a handmade kind of experience. It's not, it's professional in the sense that I think the film looks professional. The ideas are quote unquote professional ideas, you know, it's not amateurish.
So how does a film like that or the entries into the wildlife or documentary film festivals recover their costs or even earn money?
Well, you know, yeah, it's a good question. No, a lot of it is, in particular for documentary, you know, if it's funded up front and the filmmakers are able to kind of support themselves doing it, then I think that's seen as a victory in a lot of ways. There are streaming services, of course, and there are distributors, theatrical distributors and educational distributors who are interested in documentary film. There's a lot of films that are used as calling cards for other work that might be, you know, paid, you know, gun for hire type stuff. For independent film, and documentary is really some of the most independent that there is, it's few and far between that there's just money laying around for people to make.
So they're labors of love, really.
In a lot of ways. I mean, with that said, I mean, I was just at the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival last week and heard a number of stories about acquisitions of films, feature and short. It's, you know, it kind of depends on the topic and then the, you know, is there interest in a market?
I also want to go back to the Roxy for a second. It has a storied history.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share a little bit about that history?
Yeah, you know, the Roxy was built in 1937 as a neighborhood theater. It was a second-run theater, which, you know, that meant that films would play elsewhere, and then they would come on their second run to the neighborhood. So they would open downtown at the Wilma or the Fox. Or, you know, it was built by this family, the Paisleys, and shortly after they opened the theater in 37, they sold it to the Wilma folks. Edna Wilma owned the Roxy Theater. The Wilma, it was actually the Wilma's own second run, which was, I think, not uncommon. Organizations owned several theaters in one town, have a first run theater, have a second run theater, maybe even a tertiary theater, like way out in the sticks if it was a big enough town. So the Roxy remained in the orbit of the Wilma for many, many years. In the 1970s, it kind of went from being second run into pornography. So it was kind of a local porn theater, but not exclusively. Some films played there, like we have a great picture of the marquee that says Last Tango in Paris, and a big line of people down Higgins Avenue waiting to get in. So, I mean, that movie was rated X, so I think it was attractive to the Roxy because they were already showing X-rated programs.
But it starred Marlon Brando, so it was a mainstream actor that was
exactly, yeah. I mean, it was one of the few, at that point, like... Midnight Cowboy, Midnight also Cowboy. Rated X,
right.
And a handful of films that had either a lot of violence. I think, I might be wrong, but I think The Wild Bunch originally.
Wild Bunch, X-rated, I think.
Yeah. In the 70s, it was the theater that hosted the regular screenings of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. In the 80s, it was a kind of sleazy dollar show. And then in 1994, it was burned to the ground. Shortly after the death of the Wilma owner, Eddie Sharp, who had inherited the Wilma from Edna Wilma, and the Roxy, and the Go West Drive-In, as a matter of fact. Eddie passed away and apparently had promised the theaters, or the Roxy in particular, to two different people. And the story goes, even though it's an unsolved arson, that the person who was promised the theater that didn't get it burned it down. And it was a massive fire. All the soft goods in that place just went up, and the doors blew across Higgins Avenue. In fact, I've just acquired a really wonderful photograph that is being framed right now of the Roxy in that period between somewhere between probably 96 when it was just sitting there. It reopened as a dollar show. It was a fight for the land, but the Roxy prevailed and they rebuilt it as a three screen, which for our purposes is ideal. It was originally just one 600 seat auditorium, which would be extremely difficult to do what we're doing. You know, it did not fare very well as a dollar show, lasted about a year and a half, 2 years, and the International Wildlife Film Fest purchased it in 01 or 02.
And tell me about what vinyl records have to do with the Roxy Theater.
Well, I'm an avid vinyl collector personally. I'm a nut. A few years ago, 10 years ago, I went to the Spokane Public Radio's vinyl show or whatever, their media sale. And I thought, this is a great thing. We should have one of these in Missoula. And it's like records donated from throughout the community and sold for a buck a piece or something like that at this big event center. And, you know, Spokane's quite a bit bigger than Missoula, so I didn't imagine it being that. But I did imagine that having a record sale at something like the Missoula Senior Center, which is right across from the theater, and inviting vendors and then getting donations from our community so the Roxy would sell stuff as well, that could be successful. So I connected with some folks. So it's been a thing now we've done for the last 4 years. It's been super successful. We raised several thousand dollars for the theater. We bring in a dozen this year. I think we've got close to 20 different vendors selling records and CDs and tapes, but mainly records, since the fanaticism is really around vinyl and not so much around 8-tracks, for example. But yeah, people selling records all day long, and all the proceeds from entry of the door and from the Roxy's own sales and from generous donations from those vendors, all those proceeds go to support the Roxy Theater.
Mike, what's the most challenging part of your job?
I think one of the most challenging parts of running the Roxy is also the most rewarding part, and that's the fact that I'm always on. I am the representative of the Roxy Theater, so I can't flip you off in traffic. You know, and Missoula is the great kind of community where you get a lot of work done at the grocery store because you run into those five people and then, you know, hey, I got to call you. Okay, great. Hey, do you know we're showing that movie? You know, so your promotional work out there in the community is happening always, or mine is. And I like that, actually. I like that in a lot of ways, the work that I do day to day is also my identity in the community. And it's nice that that work is appreciated for the most part, and that people are willing to say, hey, Mike, I like what you're doing. And so in that regard, it's very rewarding, you know. And I would say of all the jobs at the Roxy, it is the job that I would say is not thankless, because people are incredibly generous. And what they probably don't realize, though, is that I'm just this very tiny piece. I happen to be leading the group, but I'm this very tiny piece in what makes the theater what people seem to like so much about it.
Mike, what advice do you have for new filmmakers, and what should they know about making films, most importantly, from a business perspective?
They need to know that they really do need to find somebody else to fund this idea, because it's a long, long road. It's a really long road. So if they're only thinking about it in short term, like, oh, sure, I've got $5,000, I can make this movie, that's not even half of it. And I don't mean financially speaking, but that's not even half of it in terms of the work of getting a movie made is arguably easier now than it ever has been. It's a question of getting it out into the world to be seen is the real challenge.
What's the future hold for Mike Steinberg?
Oh, I'm going to, go get a cup of coffee. I don't know. I mean, I love the Roxy. I love what we've done here. And I love this community. And I love the way that our cinema and our festivals, I love the way that it's embraced and supported. So in that regard, more the same. You know, I feel like doing something right, just keep doing it. And I like to think that organizationally as well as personally, there's this kind of, you know, tendency to be responsive. You know, I don't ever want to be one of those people who's been running an organization for, God, 20 years, and people are like, yeah, that guy. I've had enough experiences like that. And it doesn't serve the organization. It doesn't serve a nonprofit. It certainly doesn't serve the arts community. So I hope the future for me is more like, when it's clear that I'm in the way, I get out of the way.
Mike, thanks for joining me today
and
sharing your passions. I appreciate your listening to Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guests' contact information and content from all our shows. Join us next time when our guest will be businesswoman and social entrepreneur Sarah Calhoun. founder of Red Ants Pants Clothing Company and the wildly successful Red Ants Pants Music Festival. Once again, I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you peace and prosperity.